acre, whatever your average cost is you're paying, with them to protect you, other than the fact you don't like it.
Yeah, Representative Markham, that's probably something we could do.
Okay, well, I'd ask you to look into it then.
It would require some form of agreement.
I mean, if you'd been cooperating with them, we wouldn't have the problem we're looking at today, it looks to me like, if in fact you could work a deal with the fire district.
Are there any other questions? Thank you.
Nice to see you again, Al.
Word fire chief.
I had to bring you all up to see my old friends.
You want to get him up here?
See if you can get together with those guys. No, I'm just trying to resolve the problem.
Well, I think if we pass this bill out, they'll be closer than they've ever been before.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Weehaven.
I wonder if we might give Dennis an opportunity to come back and just respond to that comment, because there was a conflict in the testimony here, maybe he could clarify at that point.
Representative Weehaven would like you to clarify something.
Dennis, you said that there were no wages included in the bill. Could you clarify?
The billing that we submitted, since we followed the state, the form out of the state fire marshal's office, does call for a category for wages. In the past, when our district has billed under that, that has gone directly to the fire district, that portion for wages, as well as the amount for equipment. Volunteers have a volunteers association, and out of that, the board is usually delegated some of that money that would go to the volunteer association for that. They might buy, most of that's gone to a benevolence fund to take care of firefighters who might be injured or families, something of this nature.
I see. All right.
So that accounts for that item.
Representative Markham.
Could you work out a deal with the state parks?
We thought we were close to that at one point. However, nothing ever materialized, and so that's why we're here.
Do they stonewall you and say, well, we're a nonprofit, so we don't want to do business?
No, there was just, it was our understanding, we met in March or late February, I believe, with Dave and some representatives from state parks, and also Bob Shoemaker, I believe, was involved in that meeting. It was our understanding then that there would be something that would come out of that meeting. However, nothing did, so we went.
It did come out right here.
That's why we're here.
Representative Weehaven.
How many acres of state land are there in District 14?
I think the 23, in the testimony that the chairman submitted, 2,300 acres, which he indicated are about one-fifth of our total district. I'm sorry, about 10%. Of our total district is state park land.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing and open the work session on Senate Bill 28. Chair will move House Bill 28 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Edward?
Representative Cease?
You come back to me, I don't know what I'm voting on. Still, I mean, it says required state, does that mean the state parks?
Mm-hmm.
It says it in there.
Representative Oakley?
Mm-hmm. Aye.
Okay, we'll get it.
Representative Stein?
Aye.
Representative Weehage?
Aye.
Representative Markham?
Aye.
Representative Young?
Aye.
Representative Cease?
Aye.
Passes.
Can we take 358?
Yeah, let's go to Senate Bill 358. And why don't you bring us up to date on this, John? And why don't we get LCDC and Stonewall?
Mr. Chair, if you'll remember.
Why don't you come up to an if, in fact, we go on the back?
Mr. Chair, if you remember, we already passed the Senate Bill 358 out of the committee once. Between the time it passed out of the committee and it made its appearance on the floor, representatives of the Department of Land Conservation and Development indicated that there is a conflict between language in this bill and some existing language in the statutes relating to EFU zoning, and they suggested that a change be made in the bill to resolve that conflict. In addition, a representative from the Oregon Association of Realtors requested that some language be added to the bill to clarify a particular point. It's my understanding that the original sponsors of the bill are in agreement that both of these amendments are okay, so our purpose today is just to hear a little bit more in terms of the background behind the amendments before we take action on the bill again.
You want to identify yourself for the record? We don't get a chance to beat up on LCDC very often, so...
We've got it between us.
I apologize to the committee ahead of time.
Sure.
Given the fact that...
Welcome.
Chairman Young, members of the committee, my name's Ron Eber, and I'm the legal policy coordinator and rural land specialist for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And briefly to the amendment, we want to apologize for the lateness of the comments, but appreciate the committee's willingness to correct this, what we saw as a technical oversight in the bill as it went through. But as we read it, the exemption that was proposed to the partitioning statutes for the purchase of right-of-way by a public body or for a road project would conflict with the statutory exclusive farm use zone, because road expansions now within an exclusive farm use zone, which require the purchase of right-of-way, are a conditional use. And this would have simply sidestepped that whole process, and you would have had a road expansion subject to a conditional use project where the county or whoever the public body was out buying the right-of-way without any double check that it in fact complied with the comprehensive plan. So we talked with the representative of the Association of Oregon Counties, as well as the Attorney General's office, and came up with this proposed language. This would simply ensure that before the county or public body went out to purchase the right-of-way or the additional for the road or whatever, that they checked with the planning department to see that in fact the comprehensive plan had that road project or right-of-way in the plan, and therefore it was in compliance with the plan. We don't see this as requiring any additional procedure. Counties now utilize what they call a zoning clearance letter, where someone in getting a building permit or something double checks with the other county department that in fact it complies with the comprehensive plan. Otherwise, the exemption from the partitioning statutes I think is a good one, because once you've got a road project in the plan as and it's planned for and it complies with the applicable plan, there's no reason to subject the individual property purchase to individual partitioning requirements. That could be quite cumbersome for a long mile-by-mile stretch of highway.
Okay, if we put this language in, if the county wanted to upgrade a road and it didn't go beyond the right-of-way that's presently there, they wouldn't have to do anything different than what they do right now. Say they just wanted to put 2 feet of pavement on either side of a road and it didn't affect the right-of-way itself.
Chairman Young, I believe nothing new would be required, because this talks about the purchase of the right-of-way. If it's within an existing right-of-way, then there's nothing required.
Okay, how do you function on presently? Marion County put a new road that goes from 219 just south of the Charbonneau bridge over the Willamette, and they put a new road that connects to Highway 219 with a another county road. How does LCDC get involved in that? It was a brand new road, brand new right-of-way.
Chairman Young, where we would have been involved initially was when we first reviewed and acknowledge the Marion County Comprehensive Plan. Presumably that particular road project or similar road projects would be part of the transportation element of the plan, where they would lay out the roadway grid for different size roads. And so if in that case they were simply now constructing the roadway that was in compliance with the plan, it went forward. If in fact the county was amending its plan to propose an entirely new road, then that's a plan amendment, and through the plan amendment process we would review it at that level. Otherwise, if this project was already part of the comprehensive plan, we would have had no review of it at all. It would have just gone forward under the plan.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Well, I understand that one of the problems, the conflict here was not simply even the larger issue of LCDC, although those plans have been approved, those larger plans, plan approval, but the real issue is this bill, I think the fall was, it would have allowed the county to, in effect, violate its own plan. Because it could have gone ahead with going ahead with the right-of-way without even having that taken care of its own plan, wouldn't it, the way that bill was put together?
Chairman Young, Representative Cease, that's correct. There are times when one arm of the county is not in sync with the other arm, and it's possible that somebody could have been out purchasing right-of-way, or in fact an individual could grant right-of-way or an easement to the county for something that's not consistent with the plan.
Sure. Representative Markham.
We have the same problem with LCDC occasionally, don't we? Having to do with secondary lands is a good example, but we don't need to get into that. Let me ask you a question.
See, I told you I was going to have to apologize.
Where are we on the proposed new highway south and west of 217 in Washington County? Do the county engineers say we need that, and state engineers say all their studies show we need that new freeway to connect up to the Sunset with I-5?
Chairman Young, Representative Markham, I'm not familiar with the specifics on that, but my understanding is that the need for that roadway is still under discussion both by the state and the county.
And if they make a determination that it's necessary, then do you people have to give your stamp of approval?
To the extent that the roadway project and the need basis for it is added to the county's comprehensive plan, that it would come through our review process.
As to what the county wants? Or do you get involved in how wide a right-of-way they ought to have? How far detailed do you get in the highway business? Well,
Chairman Young, Representative Markham, not being a transportation planner, I'm not completely clear how detailed it would be, but I think the big issue would be the need for the roadway, and particularly the location of it as it would interface with agricultural or forest lands or other urban issues in terms of interchange development, etc. Those would be the big issues.
Do you have a highway planner in your department?
There is someone who's familiar with transportation issues.
Thank you. I think on the bypass, it was on a revised comprehensive plan that went to LCDC and was approved in concept along with some other things, but whether it was in detail or not, I'm not mm-hmm. sure. This would cover state highways too.
Yes, Chairman Young, it refers to state highway, county road, city street, or other right-of-way purposes. So it could be transmission lines, underground power lines, whatever.
Okay, Chuck, do you have any comments?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Chuck Pearson from Washington County. We have no quarrel with the amendments. This particular Section C was proposed by the Oregon State Highway Division to preclude them from having to partition property every time they bought a parcel of right-of-way on an existing road mm-hmm. or for a new road. And they're fine with us.
Okay, are there any other questions of LCDC? You may be excused, but you may need to be called back at a moment's notice.
Thank you, Chairman Young.
Thank you. Kelly?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Kelly Ross representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. First of all, I'd like to extend our appreciation for the committee's indulgence to comment on this.
Were you and LCDC having a meeting when we heard this bill, or why was nobody here? That's a rhetorical question.
I know you guys get delays in the process. I never try to speak for LCDC.
You'd like to.
Our attorney had some uneasiness with Section 4, in particularly the term no person shall sell. because it was his feeling that in some cases the term sell has been interpreted to mean offer for sale. And that's of concern to us because it's a common practice to offer for sale parcels prior to partition simply to accommodate the particular needs of a prospective buyer. Offer it for sale to find out whether the prospective buyer might want a partition of 2 20 acres or 2 17 acre and 13 acre, whatever. So by inserting the term convey any interest in a parcel, it allows that marketing and negotiation to go on prior to the actual partition. And also appreciate the cooperation of the sponsors of the bill to accommodate that change.
So this is like, say you have a house with enough property that there could be an extra lot.
Right, or even...
And you might want to offer it for sale, saying home with possible second building site.
Right, or even vacant property that could be partitioned.
Either as one large lot or three smaller.
Right.
Have you checked those over, Chuck?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. We have absolutely no problem with this. If they feel it clarifies the language of the law a little better, we're very agreeable to
you. You guys are really easy to get along
with. It's getting late in the session.
Okay, are there any other questions? Do you want to see if we can round up the quorum?
We've got a quorum here.
Oh, we do have a quorum. We have enough.
You want to do it.
I usually don't count Representative Cease in the quorum.
I'm going to be with you on
this one. Yeah, we'll see if they're out there.
He doesn't like to lose.
Is there anyone else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 358? If not, we'll close the public hearing and move into work session.
Motion.
Why don't
we? Chair, I'll move to propose amendments to B and Gross Senate Bill 358, dated 5/26/89.
Okay, Representative Markham moves the amendments to Senate Bill 358, LC 2076, dated 5/26/89. Is there any objection? Hearing none, they're accepted. Chair will move the proposed amendments submitted by the Oregon Association of Realtors, and the title on is proposed amendments to A and Gross Senate Bill.
That's included in those B and Gross amendments you just approved.
So all of those are in there?
Yes, all of those are in there.
Okay, then we don't need that amendment.
No.
Because that includes
they're all in there.
All in that one amendment, B7?
Yeah.
B7.
Mr. Chair, the amendments from LCDC are included in lines 1 through 3 of the LC amendments. Lines 4 and 5 include the amendments as proposed by the Association of Realtors. So both groups' amendments are reflected in the printed amendments that we have from Legislative Council.
Okay, we've accepted the printed amendments from Legislative Council, dated 5/26/89. You want to move the bill, Representative Markham?
You've accepted the amendment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'll move Senate Bill 358 as amended. The floor do pass.
Okay, Representative Markham moves Senate Bill 358 as amended to the floor with the do pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Edward?
Representative Cease?
Aye.
Representative Oakley? Representative Stein?
Aye.
Representative Wehage?
Aye.
Representative Markham?
Aye.
Representative Young?
Aye. Passes.
I would suggest that we go on to Senate Bill 24 now because that's also our surveyor's
bill. Okay, Senate Bill 24, sponsored by Senator Otto, at the request of the Oregon Association of County Engineers and Surveyors. Welcome back.
Yes, thank you. Maybe this will be the last time you get to see your smiling faces today.
We have two documents.
Representative Young, members of the committee, I'm Dennis Fonce, representing the Oregon Association of County Engineers and Surveyors. And you've got my, a copy of my testimony, I believe, supporting this bill. Excuse me.
This one?
Yes, dated May 26th.
Okay.
From OECES. Does everybody have a copy?
Okay, everybody.
This one is talking from.
And this bill's, the questions about it have been pretty well ironed out in committee, and we don't have any opposition to it in its engrossed form. I'd be happy to answer any questions for the committee.
Let me ask a question, Chair.
Yes, Representative Markham.
Let me ask, if you get in these very sparsely populated counties, is it going to be a problem that they do you have to have at least two that are registered land surveyors?
If I may, go ahead. Mr. Chairman, Representative Markin, Chuck Pearson with Washington County. Under current licensing laws under ORS 672, you must be a licensed land surveyor to use the term surveyor. If we had a person that was a surveyor's assistant that didn't call himself the deputy county surveyor, he could be employed by the county surveyor and work in the sparsely populated counties, as long as he was working directly under the supervision of the licensed land surveyor.
I'm not sure I'm tracking you. Does that give them the latitude they need to get the job done without without a lot of job protection there?
Yes, sir. Representative Markham, that section was added by legislative council. It wasn't part of our original draft, and they felt that in reading ORS 672 that if you use the term surveyor in the title, you must be a surveyor. Like if you use the term engineer in their title, you must be an engineer. You cannot be a sanitary engineer without having licensing as a registered professional engineer.
Let me ask another, Chair. Can a registered professional engineer do these duties without becoming a land surveyor?
No, sir, Representative Markham.
They used to be able to,
They used to be able to, and they agreed to the legislation that got them out of the boundary surveying business. They can still do construction surveying and surveying for new buildings and things of that nature. They cannot establish or reestablish boundaries between common property.
A civil may not.
That's correct.
Or any other kind of engineer, because they all come out the same breed out here at Oregon State, except what they specialize in, correct?
Correct.
We've been through that in this committee before.
I think I'll see if Tulsa wants to handle it.
Thank you.
Any questions? Okay. Is there anyone else that wants to testify on Senate Bill 24? If not, we'll close the public hearing.
Thank you.
Yeah, Roger will be 358 again.
Everything under control?
I think so. Are you ready?
If you are.
They're not confusing us with amendments this time. That's good.
Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 24 be engrossed.
Yeah, we'll open the work session.
All right.
I'm getting help from my freshman here. We got one of these.
Well, he's one of those engineers, you know.
Okay, Representative Markham.
Can't set a monument.
Representative Markham moves Senate Bill 24 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Edward?
Representative Cease?
Aye.
Representative Oakley?
Aye.
Representative Stein?
Aye.
Representative Wehage?
Aye.
Representative Markham?
Aye.
Representative Young?
Aye. Passes. And Representative Oakley would like to be registered as a yes vote on Senate Bill 358.
If you want to be registered.
Is there any objection? If not, so noted.
I bet you wanted to be registered as a land surveyor.
Probably.
Who's going to carry it?
I'll carry that with us.
Okay. Why don't we do 1098 next? That's the one that you had amendments to.
Okay. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1098.
We don't have anybody signed up. Just do and discuss your amendments.
Okay. This is the one that I requested amendments to. When the bill came in originally, the request was to expand to storm drainage fees, the lien provisions, I don't have a problem with that. I have a problem with how they're going to assess some of their things, but that's their problem, I guess. And, okay, do you want to come up, Red?
Stormwater, sir. You going to describe this thing, or are we supposed to know it? Go ahead, I don't care.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brad Higbee with the City of Portland. I've had a chance to look at the amendments right before the hearing started. With me is Dave Gooley again, the Environmental Services Bureau of the City of Portland. Was that a specific question that you wanted me to respond to just now? As I was walking up, I might not have actually heard.
No, no, just that John said that you wanted to comment on these. I don't have a problem personally with the lien as long as there's notification of the liability on the lien. Do you know how these assessments for runoff are going to be handled? If they're put on the sewer bill, how do you get to people that have unimproved properties or improved properties with no sewer service, like a say just a parking lot, for instance, and that's a tax lot, but all it is a paved parking lot that has a runoff problem, but it has no sewer to charge.
Chairman Young, the method that the City of Portland uses currently is that any property with impervious area is currently billed for drainage service, whether they're connected to a sanitary service or not, with the exception of residential properties, which we intend beginning in January to include. Previously, prior to the annexations into Mid-Multnomah County, there weren't very many residential properties without sanitary service, so billing only those that had sanitary service, also for drainage services, excluded relatively few properties. Our intent is to modify our billing system to ensure that all residential properties and all properties pay drainage services that have impervious area. So it would make no difference whether they were connected to the sanitary sewer or not.
And is it a monthly billing?
It's Chairman Young, it's a quarterly billing for all residential properties and for most, the three-quarters of our commercial customers. It's a monthly billing for about a quarter of our commercial customers. The current monthly rate billed quarterly for a residential property is $2.90 a month. And it's basically based on, I believe the rate is $1.35 per 1,000 square feet of impervious area per month.
So, well, Mr. Chairman, if I could, were you saying that you were not particularly interested in the amendments that were here to Senate Bill 1098 because it was your understanding that you would be more comfortable if there was adequate prior notification to a landlord that problems were beginning with respect to delinquencies of a tenant?
Just tell me how this comes about, and let's focus in on the sewer, the drainage water portion of it. Say I own a house in Portland and this, and perhaps the sewer bill are accruing, and you have the right to lien my property for that. Am I billed directly for the storm runoff?
Mr. Chairman, the ultimately the property owner would have the discretion of either having the city bill him or herself, or in the case of a rental, billing the tenant. For example, if it were to go to the tenant, then the quarterly sewer bill, which would include both sanitary and storm services, would go to the tenant. At the time that the tenant intended to move and informed various utility services that they were going to move, then a final bill would be sent to the tenant. At the same time, a parallel bill would go to the landlord to alert the landlord that the tenant was discontinuing service and that there were X dollars in outstanding balances due on the account. If there were then subsequent notifications to the tenant, if the tenant didn't respond, the same notifications would go to the landlord
So the landlord at that point would be kept apprised of progress on the account. After three notifications over a 90-day period, if no one has responded to the account, then the amount of the account is placed, is set up to go to the county assessor's office and placed as a lien against the property. That's done once a year. So the landlord would have some period of time, depending on the time of the year,
Mr. Chairman, if I could add to that, there's an additional notification process for that, in that notification begins to go out to the owners of property about the pending lien filing starting in April. There's another notification sent out in May and a final notice sent out in June, indicating that by July 1, a lien will be imposed.
Is any of this under statute, or does each of the 300 and some cities have a different policy on
Chairman
that provide
Young,
the service have a different policy?
Chairman Young, there is, within the current statute, authority for all county service districts, I believe, to place liens for any service provided by a county service district, which would include sanitary service, storm drainage services, or any other county-provided services. For cities, there is a statutory authority to
And then what the negative impact would be on Penn Industries. And from your comments, you feel they're quite competitive?
I feel they are competitive. We have not in this biennium went out and did a market analysis with them, because one of the things that we decided, that if Penn was going to be able to produce these to meet our needs, which has now become the standard for their operation, is that we want to make sure that as we spread these throughout our facilities, which we have 52 facilities, is that they're interchangeable, is so that when we breathe quite a bit and we move people in and move people out, so we can move these around the state. And so dealing with Penn Industries, that we've got that assurance.
Are there any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Weehead.
I just want to make this very clear about the price checking that you did do before you went to Penn Industries. Could you expand on that a little more?
Sure. At the time we were asked to go out and deal with Penn Industry, they were, I believe, substantially in the red, and did not know which way they were going to go with Penn Industry at all. There was some talk about closing it down. With our development with them and going out and researching the marketplace, is we went out and took a look at what the market would bear as building these quad pods or building these death site interview stations. Then we asked Penn, without their knowledge of what it would take to their knowledge of what the private market was, asked them to price it, and they were a little bit lower than the market would bear at the governmental discount rate as well. And so we asked them to at least bring it up to that level, so that it helped their operation. And I believe we cash flowed them on our first four projects.
What sort of price checking did you do? Did you ask for, you didn't ask for bids from these other companies, I presume. You didn't ask for a formal bid.
I can't remember what companies we went to, but we went to, I believe, two companies up in Portland and asked to see their stations and asked what kind of price they would have, and asked them also on quantity price and governmental discount price.
So it was two companies that you checked?
Yes, and I'd have to look back in our files to find out which one those were. All right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Oakley.
I'd like to inquire about the Bend office and the purchase of, what was it, some $200,000 worth of furniture within the last year. It's my understanding that was not put out on the bid process.
It was not. It was dealt directly with Penn Industry.
Was there? What was the reason that for that large of an account there was no bidding taking place?
Our understanding of the purchasing rules is that when you deal with other agencies, within governmental agencies that you do not have to go through the bidding process. You can deal with them directly. And the size of the Bend office is not unique. We have done several others of that size that have come to the close to $200,000 mark. And with the law or the rule that says we do not have to bid, we just cut a purchase order to meet the needs of the office.
So basically, you paid what they requested then?
They have a pamphlet. We cost it out. Mm-hmm. And the only questionable cost that comes to us is the installation rate. And I believe on the Bend site, they tried a private industry to install it. And so that was the only questionable one at that time.
Thank you.
Well, just one question. When you're short of money anyway, which the agency appears to be, how can you be sure that you're not spending more for furnishings than what you should be if you went to bid on it? And that money would be then available for other services, I would imagine.
Maybe I give a little history on how we go about when a facility comes up for lease rent is usually when we look at the facilities to put in the Cascade workstation. We just don't arbitrarily go out and pick any one way we feel fancy to do that. We wait for the lease document to come up.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, then we decide to put in Cascade workstations or not. And there are several sites that we will not be putting in. There are small itinerant offices that we will not be putting in. And at that point, we get a number of facility magazines and just compare prices out of the facility magazines. We have not, probably for about the last 16 months, compared any prices.
Okay. Is it fair to say that it would not put you at any hardship if we allowed Penn Industries to bid like everyone else and eliminated them as a state agency in terms of automatically getting the work without having to go to bid?
The only hardship I think I would see, since that is directly my responsibility for the agency, would be going through the bidding process and the timelines that would have to be added on to that to coordinate the negotiations of a lease. That's I mean, it's not an undoable thing. It just add more time needed to do that.
Well, how do you balance that against the fact that Penn Industries doesn't have an inventory as such? It seems like you're going to have quite a lead time on requesting the furnishings from Penn Industries anyway.
Right.
So compare those two timelines. Say you know that a building is going to be coming up for bid or lease in a year.
Sure.
Compare one to the other.
Sure. Right. Penn Industry has guaranteed us that once we set the PO and sent that to them, they guarantee me 90 days. So my negotiations, when we go into it, and we start our negotiations 1 year prior to the lease expiration, is that I can calculate and get that in. We went out through DGS and bid that, and a lot of times we bid those, it would be nothing for us to bid three or four sites at one time, and the magnitude of that could go to $600,000 or $700,000, where Penn Industry would be 90 days and they'll guarantee those. Out there through DGS's bid process, it usually takes 60 to 90 days just to go through the process to award the bid, and then it would take the manufacturer then time to build those, and so it would add on to that timeline.
So it's considerably more convenient for you, regardless of whether you're paying more
extremely
for the end product.
Extremely, as well as we've gone back and have done three modifications to the system, two from an engineering standpoint with when Jim Michelson was there, and one from strictly from a safety standpoint with some sharp corners, and they went back and we've modified them, and we've had committees to do that.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have a question on the bid process.
Mm-hmm.
Did you say that Penn Industries cannot bid?
Oh, they...
They can bid.
Yes.
Okay, that was my understanding, too. I have before me a sheet from General Services that shows a bid, and, you know, we talk about being competitive, and they did not get the bid. It went to Acoustic Panel Systems. There was basically about over $3,000 difference on a $16,000 job. And how do you explain that when you say that they are bidding and they're very competitive when this firm obviously underbid them about 20%?
Absolutely. When we went out and
that included installation.
Sure.
And it's my understanding that the bid from Penn Industries did not include installation and delivery.
Right. When we asked Penn what their... We put in a bunch of petitions within the agency. When we asked Penn, would they produce those petitions? Their petition comes with electrical base throughout. And we said we did not want their electrical bases throughout, which is a very expensive item for us. We said we just want partitions and partitions only. They did not produce those at the time, and we said, well, that's all we want. We do not want your electrical bases, so we're going to bid this out. And if you have want to opportunity to bid on it, you can bid on it. And that's when we went through the DGS process to bid on those.
You were saying at that time that they could not produce them without the electrical systems?
They would not.
Just one other question. Do you ever check with other agencies to see what they're paying for something that's comparable to what you have? I mean, I would assume like the employment division might have these interview type desks where somebody comes into a cubicle and there's needs to be room for two people and that sort of thing.
I have not. Okay. I see more and more of Penn Industries everywhere. So I haven't.
Okay, any other questions? Fine, thank you.
Mm-hmm. John Mormon.
John Mormon.
Good afternoon, Chairman.
I'm John Mormon. I'm with the Department of Justice. I'm the purchasing officer for the department. And I'm not in the same league as AFS is.
But how do you handle your purchases? And you've dealt with Penn Industries.
Oh, yes.
Mormon.
I might say that our purchases for AFS or for the department relating to Penn Industries is pretty much on a small volume basis. I just checked out 1988, and the amount that we ran through with Penn Industries was a total of $17,533. The largest one single group of that was $5,413, which was for a new office that relates to our support enforcement update unit, which was outfitting a small area, but unexpectedly so, that came about from some federal funds that was for that specific purpose with the state. Normally, our purchases are onesie-twosies. We get a Cavalier desk because we have an additional attorney coming in, or we'll get a chair or two, or quite a few maybe shelving units, that type of thing. And it is convenient. It also fits in a decor, basically, like shelves or various types of tables, that type of thing, because we have quite a bunch of them. And you talk about typing tables, and we'll buy those at 25 at a crack. They fit within the decor of an office area, and we have those in our offices throughout the state. By contrast, the idea of partitions came up. I do not believe we've ever purchased partitions from Penn Industries. We like other types of partitions, and we'll go out on bid if it's that large a unit, or quotes if it's that small an order. And as Representative Oakley alluded to, I think we've purchased from the same outfit on partitions. and we'll ask for quotes from the office supply units throughout the area for those kinds of things. Chairs is another example. We buy a limited amount of chairs from Penn Industries because we preferred chairs from the other suppliers, speaking in general.
Do they wire their chairs too?
Pardon?
Do they wire their chairs too? Or?
Somewhat.
I guess we use injection, don't we?
They destroyed that about 10 years ago.
Are there any questions?
I want them to auction
but,
off.
You could get quotes from Penn Industry if...
Sure.
I mean, if that were permissible.
Oh, yes.
And is.
I agree with the time frame problem somewhat of a bid, a formal bid through DGS, but for instance, on this update, we had to get an office space we didn't know about furnished in a period of less than 3 weeks. So it was indeed convenient to try and get 7 desks from Penn Industries.
And they met the...
Yes, they did.
...the deadline. Yes, Representative Wehage. Yes.
John, as the purchasing agent, I assume that you're up to date on pricing of products from other sources.
Try to be, yes.
What's your opinion about Penn Industries? Are they competitive?
In most lines, yes. Again, I would say their partitions are not. What AFS is purchasing in the quad type of thing is depends on what you want. And I think you can find good competitive equipment outside of Penn Industries.
Thank you.
Likewise, on chairs, I find some chairs that are less expensive than what we could get at Penn Industries. So we'll buy outside and not go through corrections. With or without bid.
You're required to go to bid over $10,000.
Yes.
On furniture?
Yes.
Is that the limit? So you wouldn't have been covered. I mean, you could have gone to a quote basis with all of your purchases.
Yes.
Anyway.
Yes. In-house, we think about it as being $5,000 anyway, and then we'll get special dispensation from DGS
okay.
if we need it. But.
Clifford Freeman, sure. He's waving at us here, and I'm not sure.
Clifford, is there a different limit?
It's...
Mr. Chairman, the,
we'll find out if justice has been following the letter or the spirit here.
Oh, yes.
For furniture, the, what's called a Class B purchase.
We're really under.
What that delegation is up to $5,000.
$5,000.
Any transactions over $1,000 must be fully documented. But,
right.
Up to $5,000, they can purchase on their own. Over that, then it must go up.
Right.
Or directly with Penn Industry, which relieves them.
Penn Industry purchases would be Class A purchases, and they're unlimited purchase amount because it's a commodity from another Oregon agency.
Okay.
I have a question for him.
Why don't you come up, Clifford, and get on the record? Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah. And just for purposes of clarification, both in the phoning that I've done trying to get people to our meetings and in the testimony we've received, there appears to be some conflict as to whether Penitentiary Industries can, in fact, bid in a competitive bidding setting for state agency work. As I understood Mr. Cameron, he said, yes, they could. And others have said, yes, they can, to me over the phone that I've contacted, and yet other people have said, no, they can't, and you've sent me an administrative rule that says, in effect, no, they can't.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hauser, my name is Clifford Freeman. I'm with the Department of General Services Purchasing Division. As I understand it, I'm not aware of Oregon Administrative Rule 125-030-60 having been rescinded. As my understanding is that is still in effect, and I don't know the circumstances that
were described earlier, where it was said that Penn Industries did submit bids. They may have been invited to send in a quote by a purchasing person. I'm not sure, but I know that the statute says that, and my understanding is that I'm just trying to. Jackie Spinner is our purchasing person, and my understanding is that I believe that Penn Industry bids have that they're informed that those bids cannot be accepted. Yeah, when they come into Department of General Services, and I'd have to check with them to find out
Did she just reject them?
He said rule one time and then statute another, which is
it's in the rule. The question I have was with the information that Representative Oakley presented. It obviously the cost of the project that she was referring to was over $10,000, $5,000. Therefore, it would have had to have gone out to competitive bid. So how could Penitentiary Industries in that instance have even given them a quote on what they would have done if, in fact, they were going through the competitive bidding process? That does not leave an option open for them to get quotes from someone outside that process, does it?
Well, if I might, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hauser, the circumstances that Representative Oakley described, I would need to know what happened in Penn Industries' bid. And perhaps people from Penn Industries can tell us. My guess is, I don't know. There are figures and bids that come in on different projects that are sometimes lower than the project that the price of the goods that are paid for that are rejected for any number of reasons. My guess is that the Penn Industry bid, although it came into General Services, was probably rejected, but I can't swear to that because I'm not familiar with this particular instance, and I don't. Do you gentlemen know anything about that?
What particular bid?
Any bid. So you haven't been awarded any bid from General Services. I'm sure of that.
My knowledge and the director is the only one I think would put one bid in, which this was not yet, to see if it would be accepted, and it was rejected.
Mr. Chair, the reason I was asking those questions is that if we proceed with this bill, there appeared to be some interest expressed by the committee members that this bill would, in effect, allow Penn Industries to become competitive by enabling them to bid on these projects. And if, in fact, that is not the case under existing administrative rule or statute, that they have the authority to do that. In addition to considering the language that's in this bill, we may need to consider additional language that specifically would permit them to bid in situations like that.
Why is the administrative rule there? Chairman Young, I understand, and this is kind of like a campfire lore or something, but because I haven't researched it, but my understanding is that that rule is an accommodation to Oregon businesses that would be in a situation of subsidizing their competition. That is to say, Penitentiary Industries is a creature of government. Taxes support the corrections institution, support the industry. Here, you pay taxes so somebody can compete against you for products and in a market where you're earning your living. My understanding is that is the reason for that rule. It was kind of felt that there would be a lot of business where either the goods or the timelines that were offered or possible for Penn Industries to supply would not meet those needed by the agency. And for that reason, there would be kind of a niche, if you will, for Penn Industries for certain types of installation projects, projects that people could get on quick order, or projects that otherwise met the needs of an agency in terms of price or timelines. But that the other furniture requirements of state agencies could be met in other ways.
But in effect, what's happening is we're not going to bid, but we're handing over $2.5 million worth of AFS work to Prison Industries, and never knowing whether we're getting the best price or not. All we're taking is the purchasing agent's word, who sets it right there and tells us that he doesn't like going to public contract bid on it anyway, which I can understand. I mean, but I'm not sure that we want to do this as a matter of convenience for purchasing agents as much as we want to make sure that agencies are not paying more than they should for things.
Chairman Young, I guess what I understood the Mr. Cameron, he testified, I think they had bought $2.5 million worth of furniture over, I think, since 1984.
Yeah, over an extended period of time.
I don't know what their average purchases are. I can tell you that some rough calculations that Fred Nichols, who's director of Penn Industries, made, would indicate that Penn Industries is only selling about 30% of the furniture to the state of Oregon, that they've only got 30% of the state market. And
is that correct, Jim?
Yeah. So 70% of it is going elsewhere. And as a matter of fact, when I came to work, the chair that I have is not from Penn Industries. It's from CBS, which is a local dealer here. They had a chair that I needed and wanted, and it was the Penn Industries product didn't appeal to me.
I don't get that, Joyce.
Right. Well, it was also cheaper than a comparable a later Penn Industries product, but
did Jeff send out for bid? Pardon me, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Markham, I did not, because it was under under $1,000. I guess I would just say that my experience is that Penn Industries is competitive in some areas with some products, and in others they are not. I don't. My opinion is that the exception that exists now that gives agencies an opportunity to do business with Penn Industries is something that helps Penn Industries, and it helps the agencies. And my experience with purchasing agents is that they are not going to find the most expensive thing they can find. And particularly in the area of office furniture, there's a lot of... we've just had a bid on what's called ergonomic chairs, and there's a lot of research recently has been afoot about this. And because so many people work at terminals now, there's a continuous motion industry injury that's getting to be a problem with workers' comp, back problems, and other types of problems that are arising because the seating is not adequate. Penn Industries introduced a line to compete with some of the private manufacturers, and Department of General Services has purchased some chairs from Penn Industries. Other agencies are making other choices from other vendors and manufacturers. We did something unusual in that we let a bid for more than one manufacturer on a price agreement. Usually it's just one price agreement per vendor, but we have several because we have an assortment of sizes of people to be accommodated in the agencies. But some agencies will look at the offerings of Penn Industries and deal with them. My understanding, well, I don't know what share they're going to get. It just came out within the last month.
Okay, are there any other questions? And what we'd like to do is move on and get some testimony from people we haven't heard from, and then give Mr. Weaver a shot, and then Penn Industries, and decide what we're going to do with the bill. Do you have anything to add, Bufford?
Mr. Chairman, no, I wouldn't have anything else to add. I could answer questions, perhaps, if there were any.
Okay, why don't you stay close in case something comes up. Sure. Okay, who do we have?
Mr. Chair.
A chair designed by a chiropractor to take care of all the workman's comp problems.
Mr. Chair, we don't have anybody else signed up, but I understand there are some other people other than Mr. Weaver from the private sector here that have come here specifically to offer testimony on the bill. We might just invite those individuals up and have them.
Yeah, anyone listen. That would like to comment on the bill, this may be your last opportunity. Come on up. Because we plan to make some decision on this today, and then it'll be out of our hands.
Okay.
Welcome.
Thank you. I tend to stutter, so things might go a little slow at times. My name's Neil Meyer. I'm the general manager of Lieber's Office Equipment Company here in Salem. Lieber's been in this business for 32 years, so we've dealt with the state quite a bit. The problem we have when competing with Penn Industries is the fact where, for instance, AFS says they're competitive is the fact that we're not dealing with the same product. It's